You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. This evening we bring you the last of a series of five programs devoted to the International Space Station. As with other shows in the series, we begin with the Beatles tribute band Love and Mercy performing Back in the ISS. Note, ISS, not Back in the USSR, which is the Beatles song.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop.
The Beatles tribute band, Love and Mercy. The song was written by Jan Hovers and it was about the International Space Station, which you might realise is the largest structure ever assembled in space. It's as big as a football pitch and has now been continuously inhabited for more than 10 years and passes over Melbourne about 7 or 8 times a day, and not directly over, but inside of Melbourne, and can often be seen in the evening sky. Now, to mark 10 years of space station habitation, NASA has prepared this feature entitled 10 Years and Counting. In it, you'll hear the voices of Bill Gerstenmaier, Associate Administrator of Space Operations, Peggy Whitson, Jeff Williams, Michelle Lopez-Alaguera, Sunita Williams, TJ Creamer, and Leland Melvin, who are astronauts, or were astronauts, and Michael Suffredini, the Program Manager of the Space Station.
I think if we look at station, we know we've kind of really spent past 10 years assembling space station. We built a tremendous facility in space. You know, we have probably the most phenomenal research facility ever available in space to take advantage of microgravity, has a vacuum system, high rate data, video, all kinds of capability that any research lab on the ground would be proud to have. So our next challenge will be to take that same energy, that same zeal that we put into assembly and apply it to research and utilization. So we've done research all along as we were assembling, but we weren't able to focus and spend the quality time on the research activities that we will be able to now. It's nice, we know we have a nice 10-year period as Congress has given us some extension dates out to 2020, so we know we have a good period of time, and it's up to us and the team to go utilize the research community that's out there and then make sure we get some really quality research on board space station.
Well, the gee whiz thing is the zero gravity. Having a long-term laboratory with zero gravity is very unique, and I think it's one that I hope that we will reap the benefits from in the future from a scientific perspective in a much more active way.
We are the experiment. And initially when people hear me say that, they think that I'm talking about the crew members being guinea pigs for life sciences experiments. And certainly there's an element of that. We give a little blood and other things in pursuit of that kind of research. But when I say we are the experiment, I'm talking about the entire team of government agencies and the international partnership and all the contractor teams that support in the development of the ISS, the hardware, software, the integration, the testing, the assembly, and then the day-to-day operations. All of that is so significant in scope and magnitude and complexity, but the team has pulled it off. To that extent, I think that is the great experiment of ISS.
We don't just take the money and launch it into space. We aren't sending dollar bills or $100 bills into space. We're actually investing the money. So all of the effort that goes into conceiving and designing and constructing and operating and launching a space vehicle requires a lot of thought, and that thought actually produces things that are over and above what was the intention in the beginning. So the classic example is that because of the effort to get to the moon in the 60s, there was a lot of miniaturization, and that miniaturization ended up spinning off into a lot of things for which we today can do things like talk on cell phones and take HD video with cameras that fit in your pocket and that sort of thing. So likewise, in the future, people will be reaping the benefits of the efforts that are underway today to go into low Earth orbit and to operate the ISS, or someday go beyond there. And we don't know what they are today, but the one thing that I'm sure of is that something more than just spaceflight itself will come out of it.
I think the more glorious part of space travel is the launch. And so everybody thinks about space travel during a shuttle launch or a Soyuz launch. But the International Space Station is a little bit more unique because people are actually living and working up in space 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And what that means is that there's a myriad of people on the ground all over the world making sure that every aspect of that spacecraft is working correctly and the crew on board is healthy and safe.
The shuttle's been invaluable to allowing us to build station. The components that were delivered to space by the shuttle, there's no other way we could have really got those elements to orbit other than through the space shuttle. And also, the space shuttle's been more than just a delivery of these elements. It's been our work platform. It brings its own robotic arm to help with assembly. It brings its own airlock, which we used early on for the crews to go do spacewalks from. So, and it also brings a working crew. The seven crew members are there to help and assist in the assembly operations. So each assembly flight was unique in its own right. The shuttle not only brought the hardware, but it brought the workers. It brought the work platform to work off of. And it was the asset that made station possible. If it wasn't for shuttle, we could not have built the station that exists today.
Space Station is the culminating engineering effort of 15 countries. Children should be able to look up and in simple awe and wonder that we have accomplished this engineering feat, that folks can float and do wonderful science and learn more about what we're doing on Earth, as well as going farther. And the third thing I would say is it provides a goal, maybe an inspiration for the children to be able to want to contribute to our future. Together, we are building the future.
To participate is much, much more than somebody who understands math and science. It is individuals that understand math and science. It's individuals that can communicate clearly, individuals that understand other languages and other cultures. And so kids should go to school. They should specialize in what they're good at and what they're interested in, with an understanding that that will apply their goals, hopefully, to participate in the exploration of other planets in the future.
Looking back on the contribution that the International Space Station made for, you know, civilization, when we have, you know, school children now in middle school, you know, and then building a colony and living there and having their kids there, and we say that this one step in low Earth orbit with the ISS was what got us there. You know, it was the springboard, it was the lifeboat, it was the piece that made it all happen. And that's what legacy is all about, building from one piece and then looking back and saying that's what got us to where we are now. And it's all about, you know, inspiring the next generation of explorers that will be those people walking on the Martian surface.
We have built this with nations that have not always been friendly with each other. And together here, we've actually built this platform. Together here, we're building what's going to happen next. And together, we are responsible for their future. And together is our future.
15 nations. One. International Space Station. Together is the future.
That feature courtesy of NASA. More about the space station in a moment.
Each year across Australia in community radio stations like ours, more than 5,000 volunteer broadcasters are provided with media skills training. Skills used in broadcasting, but also in people's work and communities. This training and experience has been the beginning of many paid media careers. This training means that community broadcasters can share with you a passion for music, local affairs, a language, culture, a cause, a community.
Tell your local politicians about the importance of your local community station. Community broadcasting, our voices, our vision.
Spoken by Anthony Boxshaw and Tracy Hutchinson. Authorised by John Martin, 144 George Street, Fitzroy.
You're listening to The Space Show. In Program 3 of this five-part series, we tried to bring you comments about what the next two crews of the space station will be doing while aboard the orbiting complex. Unfortunately, I had mislabeled the recording and so couldn't share it with you. The problem has now been sorted out, and so here we go with the missing program segment. Dina Contella is the Expedition 32 and 33 lead flight director. The crews on the space station have been numbered sequentially since Expedition 1 in 2000. Currently, Expedition 30 has just finished living aboard the space station, and three of its members landed just the other day. The expeditions often overlap, which can make their numbering a little confusing. And so the three remaining crew members aboard the space station are now calling themselves Expedition 31, and another three members of Expedition 31 will be launched in a few days' time. Now, here's what Dina had to say about the planned activities of Expeditions 32 and 33.
Well, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Things are going extremely well on orbit, and the crew's in great spirits right now. And I'm here to talk to you about Expeditions 32 and 33, and I'm going to start off by talking about the crew. Expedition 32 starts off with Joe Acaba, Gennady Padalka, and Sergei Revin on board. Joe's our U.S. segment lead. He flew on STS-119. Gennady will be the space station commander for Expedition 32, which will make him the first three-time commander of the ISS. He was also previously a Mir space station commander. Sergei is a rookie flyer, and he'll be flight engineer, too. In this graphic, the lower right photo shows the 31 Soyuz crew that joins Gennady's crew. Sonny Williams on the left will take over as Expedition 33 commander after Gennady Soyuz departs. She was a flight engineer on Expedition 14. Next is Yuri Malenchiko, who flew on Mir, STS-106, Expedition 7, and Expedition 16. Then you see Akihiko Hoshide on the right, and we call him Aki. He flew on STS-124. This crew of six is extremely experienced, with more than 1,300 cumulative hours in space before they've even flown this mission. And they have a combined 18 spacewalks under their belts. When Gennady, Joe, and Sergei leave, Sunny's crew of three remains on board for about a month, and then the 32 Soyuz crew comes on board. In the lower right, you see Kevin Ford on the left, who was the pilot on STS-128, and he'll become the Expedition 34 commander when Sunny leaves. Olev Nevetsky and Evgeny Tarelkin are next. They're both rookie flyers, and they'll be the flight engineers. Sunny, Yuri, and Aki undock on November 12th, which ends Expedition 33. So at this stage, in addition to the Soyuz and Progress operations, we're very happy that we have almost all of our U.S. cargo arriving on Japanese and European and commercial vehicles up to ISS. And I have a video which shows, you know, a depiction, as Mr. Sefardini pointed out, of how vehicle traffic might look in this summer time frame. Here you see the station's starboard side and the configuration it will be in at the time frame when Gennady, Joe, and Sergei are on board. The first vehicle I want to point out is the 30 Soyuz, which is the vehicle that Gennady, Sergei, and Joe arrive in. And this is their return vehicle as well. Next, I've highlighted the 47 Progress docked to the Piers module. This Progress vehicle is specially outfitted with a new external rendezvous and docking antenna that on future vehicles will allow them to delete four other antennas. Although for this initial Progress docking, the standard antennas will be used. Our Russian colleagues are making this change because some of the original components are no longer easily produced. And the change also reduces mass and power requirements on future vehicles. On the far left, the European automated transfer vehicle, Eduardo Amaldi, is docked to the aft end of Zvezda, and the onboard crew will already have been unloading it and filling it with trash for disposal. Next, the 30 Soyuz arrives, carrying Yuri, Sunny, and Aki, and it docks to Resviet on Zarya's Nader side. After docking, the crew really hits the ground running with their post-docking onboard emergency training, some key science gathering associated with their first days on orbit, and preparations for the next vehicles to come and go. Following docking, they could have a quick series of three vehicles undocking, docking, and berthing in the next 10 days. So first, the Progress. Our Russian colleagues would like to test their new antenna and avionics. And if their test is successful, new Progresses starting in 2013 or 2014 will start incorporating this new system. So after its nominal initial docking, the crew will change out the standard avionics system with the new avionics internally. This 47 Progress will undock and perform some phasing burns that will take it out to 400 kilometers. We'll perform an automated redocking of the vehicle 2 days later using the new rendezvous system. Next, I'm showing you the H2 Transfer Vehicle 3 arriving at ISS. We're planning on having Joe, Aki, and Sunny perform the track and capture by grappling the free-flying vehicle using Canada Arm 2. HTV has internal cargo, and it also has an exposed pallet with some attached payloads that will be extracted robotically. After HTV berthing, 47 Progress that I talked about previously will undock again, but this time for good, but 48 Progress quickly takes its place. At this point, the Nader Port of Harmony is occupied by HTV, so our team, as Mr. Sefardini mentioned, is getting products ready to support the robotic relocation of HTV to the Zenith port, if needed to make way for SpaceX-1 and the orbital demo missions. We're likely going to complete our exposed pallet operations before that move. Next, you'll see SpaceX Dragon, shown on that Nader port. SpaceX One is the second Dragon vehicle to visit, and it'll be berthed approximately 30 days. Next, I'm showing you Orbital Cygnus docked to the Nader port, and we're looking forward to welcoming this first Cygnus flight. There are separate press conferences planned for the HTV, Dragon, and Cygnus missions, so you'll receive a lot more information about those in the future. Next, I've highlighted ATV, which will depart late in the increment. Gennady and Yuri will be in charge of the end dock, and 49 Progress will dock to this port later. Next, you see Gennady, Sergei, and Joe Soyuz, which is the next to leave, at which point Sunny will take command. They'll have an extended period of 3 crew person ops, and this is going to be about 1 month, which is much longer than the standard 2-week period. Then Oleg, Kevin, and Yevgeny Soyuz arrives at the same port, which is 32 Soyuz, and they're there until the end of increment 33 when Sunny, Yuri, and Aki leave, and Kevin takes command. So, yes, we'll be conducting a lot of research on board, and you can also see that it's going to be a very busy time with several vehicles coming and going. So, as Mr. Severdini mentioned, we are carrying a U.S. EVA on the books and also a Russian EVA. The U.S. EVA is U.S. EVA 18. Sunny will be EV1 and Aki will be EV2. They'll be in extravehicular mobility units, EMUs, on the U.S. segment out of the Quest airlock. The first task is the removal and replacement of that main bus switching unit 1, which we can't currently command to, and we'd like to get that replaced before the Russian multipurpose logistics module Nuaka comes up in 2013. Here you see Aki on the top of the screen, and he's riding on Canada Arm 2 installing a new MBSU onto the S0 truss in the neutral buoyancy laboratory. Sunny's the free-floating crew member in the lower right corner. It's a pretty big box, about 3.5 feet long and 236 pounds. The crew will also be routing 2 cables. They're 38 feet and 70 feet long. These are power cables that we're going to route on the U.S. segment right up to the Zarya interface on the Russian segment. And these will be used to feed power to Nuaka in the future. So in terms of get-aheads, we do have one get-ahead associated with covering the PMA, and I have a video for that. Basically, we're going to install a protective cover over the end of PMA 2. Here you see them installing a similar cover on PMA 3 during the EVA on STS-135. We've improved the cover design to make it easier to install this time around. So other get-aheads include the prepping of the Zarya power and data grapple fixture that basically we have a grounding wire that we'd like to clear, and we would like to route some and route a cable to that in order to allow it to be used. So we have a lot to think about regarding this EVA, still quite a bit up in the air. And now I'd like to talk about the Russian segment EVA. It's Russian segment EVA 31. The EVA is going to be in Orlan spacesuits out of the Pierce module. Gennady will be EV1 and Yuri will be EV2. The first priority is going to be to install 5 shields on the Svezda module. These shields reduce the likelihood of hull penetration should orbital debris strike the area. The crew is also going to be relocating a Strela boom from the Pierce to Zarya. On the graphic, you see Strela 1 extended to Strela 2. Since Strela 2 is going to be used to, since Strela 1 is going to be used to move Strela 2. On the next graphic, you see Strela 1 moving Strela 2 over to Zarya on the forward end, and on the right, you see its final location. Right now, the crew is also planning to release a passive spherical satellite that will allow our Russian colleagues to evaluate ground station tracking and modeling for orbital debris. In the photo on the left, you can see the sphere, which is 13 kilograms and 53 centimeters in diameter. Of course, we'll be analyzing this from an orbital dynamic standpoint. In the second photo, you can see a tool for holding the satellite on the right with someone demonstrating the deploy and a mock-up of the satellite on the left. So the get-aheads for the EVA include bringing in some material exposure experiments and also installing some struts on the Pierce EVA ladder. And so another interesting effort that we're talking about for this increment is adding on board instant messaging and also sending up to the crew some more automated procedures, or autonomous procedures that involve the ground a little bit less. And these two items are really to gather some data so that we can work towards an experiment in the future with a comm delay on ISS. Essentially, this is not something that's right around the corner, but we wanted to get these two items on board at this time so we can gather some information. You can imagine that you might need some sort of countermeasure for a comm delay, and so instant messaging might be something that you could use, something kind of like an email, that kind of thing for communication. So we're looking at those types of things on this particular increment. And additionally, I wanted to talk to you about five small satellites that we're going to be deploying. These are called CubeSats, cubic satellites. The satellites launch inside on HTV, and the crew installs them on a deployer on a platform that gets transferred to space via the Kibo airlock. The GEM RMS grabs the platform, packed with the satellites on it, and then moves it out to a location away from structure. There are three satellite units per rectangular deployer. A door on the end of the deployer opens, allowing spring force to push the satellites out. One satellite is 20 centimeters by 10 by 10, which is a double unit, and the rest are all 10-centimeter cubes. Each CubeSat has experiments conducted by universities or industry. So that's an overview of Increment 32 and 33 operations. Thank you for your time.
What the space station astronauts and cosmonauts will be doing later this year, as described by Dina Contella, and she's the lead flight director at the Johnson Space Center. A few weeks ago, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden was called up to Washington's Capitol Hill to explain to a House of Representatives committee President Obama's budget request for NASA. Whilst there, Bolden was asked by Congressman Wolf to explain the science being done on the International Space Station. Here's how that discussion went.
The cost of maintaining the International Space Station and transporting astronauts to it won't be worthwhile if we don't do a better job of maximizing the research potential. Out of the $3 billion that we spend annually on the International Space Station, only $229 million is for research, and more than half of that is for supporting infrastructure and administrative costs. Are our investments in International Space Station research and the returns on those investments enough to justify the continuing expense of running the station?
Yes, sir. There are a couple of things there. We have what we call, there is a governing body called the Mission Control Board that is subordinate to the heads of agency, the five of us who oversee the International Space Station from the five member agencies. Bill Gerstenmaier, who heads my human exploration program, chairs the MCB, and they are looking at ways to reduce the ongoing operational cost for stations. Simultaneously, what we're doing in the United States is we have awarded a contract to an organization called CASIS.
That hasn't worked out very well.
It's going through growing pains, but we're confident it's going to work.
What were some of the other ones that applied that?
I will get back to you. I know Battelle was one of the competitors, and I will get back to you on who the others were. But the intent of that, the concept, was to take NASA out of the business of funding all research and putting it in the hands of an independent, non-governmental organization that would go out and recruit people and organizations for research on the International Space Station, and the funds that they earn will come from the investors and not from NASA. So if I look at it, I would not pay, this is just a fictional number, I would not pay CASIS $200 million to just pass through to researchers. I'll pay them a management fee of $25 million a year to take care of running the International Space Station. They will go out, and as they bring business in, so it's a business proposition for them. They go out and recruit, manage, select the participants, and the funds that come into them replace what NASA would give them to, you know, to fund researchers.
It doesn't seem like they've done very well so far, but NASA,
they just started. I'm not trying to defend anything.
Yeah, I just heard they lost their top person.
Their executive director did resign, and
they just started, and that's kind of like the captain of the ship leaving before that.
But they have a new captain in, and they're going through growing pains, and we, because we are not telling them what to do. We have provisions in place. They have milestones that they have to meet, and we have sent them, or we are in the process of sending them another letter to remind them of the milestones, to remind them of the plan, and then we'll see how they go.
NASA seems to be utilizing its own International Space Station resource space, but the National Lab portion of the space station is underused. If you looked at it from, and this is not a very good analogy, but there were 50 apartments open for lease there that you could be leasing out to the drug companies to find a cure for cancer or for Alzheimer's or autism. How many of the apartments are leased? I mean, how many have, that's not a very good way to ask you, but I'm just trying to, from my own mind, how much capacity is being used and how much is still available for people to come in?
Congressman, quite a bit of the capacity is being used, but there is room for people to come in, and that's the purpose for bringing in an outside organization, to try to find people that we would not find, to try to find organizations that do different types of research than we did.
How many work for them?
For CASAS, for the company? I will get that information for you, sir. I don't know how large they are.
I wonder if you wouldn't have been better. Was that a legislative decision, or was that a decision that you all made?
I will find out for sure, but I think it was collaboration between us and the Congress. We always wanted to have an independent entity, a non-governmental entity, and we may have, and I will take it for the record to find out, you know, whether there was legislation involved in the stand-up of the organization.
Now, you fund them, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That was NASA Administrator and four times Space Shuttle pilot Charlie Bolden singing the praises of the scientific research being done on the International Space Station. He was speaking to a congressional committee hearing in Washington, D.C. We have more about the space station coming up in a moment.
Where today's community news makes conversation, the great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Space Exploration Technologies, otherwise known as SpaceX, is a company based in Hawthorne in California. They have a rocket they've designed called the Falcon 9, and a spacecraft called the Dragon. And they have announced that their first Dragon mission to the International Space Station is now targeted for May the 19th. They did a launch dress rehearsal on April the 30th, which involved a practice countdown and a brief firing of the Falcon 9 rocket's 9 engines. That's where the 9 comes from in the name Falcon 9. The Dragon will carry nearly 600 kilograms of cargo to the International Space Station. And the Falcon 9 rocket with the Dragon capsule is actually at the moment on Space Launch Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Station awaiting that launch. At a media briefing in Houston recently, Holly Ridings, the flight director at NASA, and we heard a little of her earlier in the show, was asked by one of the reporters about the timeline for the docking of this mission.
This is Philip Sloss with NASAspaceflight.com. I believe this is for Ms. Ridings. Can you talk about for an April 30th launch, when would the red arrow that you talked about on the slide for the racetrack that you're doing, about what time after liftoff, sort of mission off time, would that begin?
Okay, so for an April 30th launch, launch is 11:22 a.m. Central Daylight Time, and you get to the right before the red arrow is on the order of 38-39 hours. So if you were using shuttle nomenclature, which the NASA folks still do, it'd be a flight day 3 fly under. So flight day one launch, flight day two is really, we call it far field phasing, flight day three fly under, so 38, 39 hours. The fly under itself is on the order of 3 or 4 hours where we're gathering that data. And then if you remember kind of from the red arrow all the way around, roughly 22 hours. And so you're coming back the next day really for a flight day four berthing, rendezvous and berthing. So I'll go through it one more time. Slower, flight day one launch, flight day two phasing, flight day three fly under, which is May 2nd in our scenario, and then a flight day four proximity operation rendezvous and berthing, so May 3rd. The capture itself, kind of early morning, central daylight time, 7:30, of course, crew day, that's kind of midday crew day. So the activities will start pretty early in the morning, Houston time, and even earlier in the morning, California time. But the capture would be about 7:30 a.m. In the morning is what it'd be planned for on that May 3rd.
And that was the flight director at the Johnson Space Center, Holly Ridings, telling us about the planned timeline. Now, as I said, that launch has now slipped and now will be May 19, and so the dates and time she gave has also slipped down a few days. Also at that briefing were William Gerstenmaier, the Associate Administrator of Human Exploration at NASA headquarters, and Mike Safradini, the International Space Station's Program Manager. And they were asked a question by the media as well when they were there.
Eric Berger again with the Chronicle. A quick question for Bill or Mike. Could one of you address the feeling inside the space program with this launch coming up? Because this is an American company, and obviously there's been a lot of heat on NASA in the last couple of years, relying on Russian rockets for humans, and this is a potential way out of that. Is it something that a lot of people are looking forward to, or how would you characterize the mood sort of leading up to the launch?
You want to do mood or do I do mood?
You can do mood.
Thanks. From our perspective, what you're referring to is probably a combination of perceived emotions way back when we started down this road, because it had to do with getting out of the space shuttle business and getting into a commercial venture, and that probably played a little bit of the role of a misconception and perhaps not everybody being completely behind this effort. But I can tell you from a program perspective, and those are the people that I see and talk to every day, we couldn't be more pleased with what we're off to go do. And the reason is, A, it provides indigenous capability within the U.S. to supply the ISS, which we think is very important. It does have implications to human transport, again, to ISS. It's commercializing, if you will, helping commercialize a low Earth orbit, which we think is a very important need and something that NASA is responsible for. And some of us, and in particular myself, believe this is a very important step for us to take in order for us to do exploration in the future. NASA needs to develop or encourage a capability and help the development of a capability, of a commercial capability to support low Earth orbit, both in terms of cargo and humans and other capabilities, robotic servicing, things like that. And NASA needs to start focusing on human exploration beyond low Earth orbit. And so those of us who are looking forward to the next step for NASA really are very excited about this next step for the space station. And we believe this is, in order for space station to be successful, these systems have to be there for us, and so we look on it very favorably and are very excited about this pending launch.
I think I'd add just a little bit, you know, this is absolutely critical to space station. We really need this cargo capability to be able to get to station, and a return capability that Dragon provides is truly unique of any one of the cargo providers, including the Russians and Soyuz.
the amount of cargo we can get back with Dragon is just phenomenal from a return standpoint. So we absolutely need this capability for ISS, and we're really rooting for the teams to come through. I think it's also been encouraging to see SpaceX to work hard issues. You know, they had some EMI, electromagnetic interference issues that they worked, and they spent some really good engineering time to resolve those issues and get them resolved. They had some engine delamination concerns, and again, they were very rigorous. They tested some things that maybe you didn't absolutely have to go test, but they wanted to go test them to make sure that they were right. That's really encouraging. So I can really, you know, get behind somebody that's doing that extra work to get ready to go fly. But as Elon said, this is really a tough flight. I mean, what we're asking them to go do on this demonstration flight is amazing. When you look at all those things that Holly talked about on her charts and the many hours that all this hardware has to work and all the software has to interact and the six computers and the 18 thrusters and all this has to work as a nice combined set to get into this precise box to be picked up by the SSRMS, that is no easy task. So this will be a very demanding mission, and we need to look at it as a test flight. It's what it should be. We'll see how well that the test works out, but they've really done a good job in getting ready for this test. So as a NASA team, we're ready to watch, participate, and help, and we truly need this capability for ISS.
You're listening to the final in a series of five special documentary features about the International Space Station. I'm Andrew Rennie. Now, these programs had their genesis as a single show to use up the recordings I made in Florida. During its preparation, a press conference was held in Houston to announce the science research being done on the space station and to give a briefing on the plans for the station operations during 2012. One program was suddenly rewritten into three. After the first program had gone to air, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden was called up to Washington's Capitol Hill to give testimony on NASA's budget request. Three programs were now extended to four. During that hearing, Bolden got into a discussion about long-duration spaceflight. He made a mention of cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev. This prompted me to do some research into Krikalev and to other long-duration cosmonauts. During that research, I came across a reference to a song having been written by, or written for, Sergei. Some more sleuthing unearthed more details about the song and the songwriter. A bit more fossicking, and I was able to get three different recordings of that song. Four programs now blew out into four and a half space shows. Then a hiccup in program three moved Diana Contella into this final episode, and the series was now five full space shows. The singer-songwriter is Cuban. His name is Silvio Rodriguez. The song is Cassiopeia. It honors cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev, who has spent more time in space than any other human. His 803 days were accumulated during six space missions. Programs 3 and 4 featured live concert performances by Silvio. Here, to complete the series of five programs, is the studio version of Cassiopeia.
Cassiopeia, Cassiopeia, Cassiopeia.
Silvio Rodriguez singing his song Cassiopeia in honor of cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev, who has lived both aboard the Mir space station and the International Space Station. Now, you can find Silvio's song on the 1993 album Rodriguez. Now, with over 40 years of experience, Silvio Rodriguez remains one of the most popular songwriters in the Hispanic world. He has written over 500 songs and has played to audiences of up to 80,000. Silvio's creative process integrates both text and music from the outset, and he usually writes both simultaneously. That concludes a series about the International Space Station, although the Space Show will continue to bring you news about Space Station activities in future programs. These programs were researched, written, and presented for Southern FM by Andrew Rennie and the Space Association of Australia.
Your voice in the community, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.